You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, episode number 505. No one has ever become poor from giving. Anne Frank.
Broadcasting from the back alley in Hollywood, it's the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, where we show you how to survive and thrive as an indie filmmaker in the jungles of the film biz. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome, welcome to another episode of the Indie Film Hustle Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari.
Today's show is sponsored by Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, how to turn your independent film into a profitable business. It's harder today than ever before for independent filmmakers to make money with their films, from predatory film distributors ripping them off to huckster film aggregators who prey upon them. The odds are stacked against the indie filmmaker. The old distribution model of making money with your film is broken, and there needs to be a change. The future of independent filmmaking is the entrepreneurial filmmaker or the filmtrepreneur. In Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, I break down how to actually make money with your film projects and show you how to turn your indie film into a profitable business. With case studies examining successes and failures, this book shows you the step-by-step method to turn your passion into a profitable career. If you're making a feature film, series, or any other kind of video content, the Filmtrepreneur method will set you up for success.
The book is available in paperback, ebook, and of course, audiobook. If you want to order it, just head over to www.filmbizbook.com. That's filmbizbook.com. And today's show is also sponsored by the Heart Chart Screenwriting Masterclass, taught by legendary screenwriter James V. Hart, the writer of Bram Stoker's Dracula, Hook, and Contact, to name a few. His unique story mapping system will teach you how to get your script ready for production and the marketplace. To gain instant access, head over to bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/heart chart. That's H-A-R-T chart. Now, today we talk about one of my most favorite topics to talk about, and I think most filmmakers want to know how to raise money for their projects. And we have filmmaker and author Maury Wazarski, who wrote the book Shaking the Money Tree. And this is essentially a masterclass on how to raise money, how to get donations, how to do something called a house party and to raise money through a house party, and how you approach investors, all the tips and tricks. I mean, I learned a ton from Maury, and I know you guys will too. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Maury Wazarski. I'd like to welcome the show, Maury Wazarski. Man, how you doing, Maury?
I'm good today. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for being on the show. I truly appreciate it. We are going to be talking all about one of my favorite topics, how to raise money to get our films made. I think every filmmaker wants to know how to get money for their films. One of the biggest problems, the biggest problems I feel, is finding money and then making money. Those are the two.
That's right.
Because finding money I've heard that from financiers. It's like finding the money is a lot easier than actually making the money after the movie is done. Like recouping that money has been harder than finding the money. But
that's right.
Two very important equations in our creative journey. But before you jump into that, how did you get started in the business?
Well, by accident, actually. Mm-hmm. I was, I'd taken a lot of film courses in college. I was at the University of Southern California, and I thought I'd be a film major, but ended up being an English major. Then I got an MA in English and went to the Graduate Writers Workshop at the University of Iowa. And I taught for a while at USC in an interdisciplinary arts program. And then through a bit of serendipity, I was invited to be an intern in the dance program at the National Endowment for the Arts. Mm-hmm. So I spent the summer with dancers. And when I got back to LA, I turned to my wife and said, I'm going to quit teaching and work with dancers. So we moved to Portland, Oregon, and I ran a dance company called Portland Dance Theater. And while I was there, I met up with people who ran the media project in Portland. And it's not there anymore, but it was a nonprofit that specialized in working with independent filmmakers doing distribution. So I picked up work by filmmakers, indies, and distributed it. And this was back in the day when video had just started. There really wasn't any video distribution. We were distributing 16-millimeter reels to schools. And I worked there for 2 years, and then I got hired to run the Bay Area Video Coalition in San Francisco. And I spent 3 years there working with independent videographers and filmmakers. And that's where I cut my teeth in working with independent filmmakers. That's where I learned a lot about fundraising.
So, I can imagine the days of distribution back before video was just basically just trying to sell 16-millimeter prints in 30. I still remember when I was in, I was in first or second grade, they had a 35-millimeter print or a 16-millimeter print. I don't even know. Probably, yeah. It might have been a 35, but who knew? It probably was a 16 of Superman 1. And they played it in the auditorium for everybody, and everyone lost their mind.
I remember
those days. Now, so you've done a lot of fundraising for filmmakers. What is the biggest mistake you see filmmakers make when trying to, you know, fundraise, trying to get money from different areas, which we'll go into in a little bit? But what do you think their biggest mistake is?
Well, there are many mistakes. I'm not sure I can locate the biggest one. I think if I had to locate one, it would be comportment, something I call comportment, which is central to my work. And if I work with a filmmaker, one of the first things I do with them is talk to them and work on their comportment, how they present themselves to the world. Mm-hmm. The attitude that they bring to the work when they're fundraising. Because, you know, I rarely meet a filmmaker who wants to fundraise. Most of them, I mean, really.
They don't.
You didn't go into film because you wanted to fundraise.
Nobody wants to fundraise. Nobody wants to distribute. They just want the fun, sexy stuff.
That's right, yeah. But it's part and parcel of the work. So once you realize that you do have to do the fundraising, it's rare that the filmmaker enjoys it. You know, it's rarely an enjoyable process. So if you bring that kind of baggage with you to the fundraising process, it's a blockage to getting money. It's a huge blockage to getting money. So what I do is when I'm working with the filmmaker, I get them very centered in really understanding why they're doing the work. And why or whether or not it's important to do it, because that's really like the bottom line. It's the basis for the fundraising, is really having a strong feeling that the work you're making must be made and that you must make it. If you can't find that, then I can't help you. Then you should make one quick film and get the hell out of the business. So that's the first square. And then the second square is, who are you? Do you understand who you are? And what your limitations are and what your strengths are. It's really important to understand where your strengths lie and how you can surround yourself with workarounds for your deficits. So I'd say that's a huge blockage. I guess I should have turned this phone on. It's always
something. But so I agree with you 100%. And you're right. I mean, I crowdfunded my first feature and I hated it. I hated it so much. It was successful and I was able to fundraise for the movie, but it was just so, I just don't like doing that kind of that kind of work. It's not for me. So my second film, I financed myself. I was like, no, I can't. I did it once. I need to do it as an experience. And also I could teach other people how I did it and all that stuff, but I won't do it again. But do you find that there is I always find this with filmmakers, especially when they're looking for money or they're looking for opportunity, or if they feel that you can give them something in their journey, that stink of desperation. It's
a problem.
Am I wrong? Problem. It's a huge problem, right?
You're right. And you cannot bring that stink of desperation to your work or it's death.
You're done.
Nobody wants to be around someone who's desperate.
Right.
So you have to understand that you have to put yourself in the shoes of the donor, mm-hmm. of the person who might want to help you. Pretend that you're them and you're meeting you and your comportment is, I'm desperate. I hate doing this. Please give me the money. I'll do anything for the money. No. It won't work. You have to bring a completely different attitude to it. And that's why the first three things I have filmmakers identify before I help them fundraise is, number one, what are your core values? Mm-hmm. Because fundraising is actually a value-laden proposition. What you're doing is you're trying to find people whose values overlay your values and the values of your project. And they're the ones who are most likely to want to support you. So you have to understand what your values are and the values of your project. And you have to broadcast those strongly in your marketing, in the way you talk to people, and how you scan the environment for who you want to work with and what opportunities you want and which opportunities you don't want. Because that will bring you money and that will defer you away from money that's never going to come your way. And then the second thing I have every filmmaker do is write a mission statement. And the mission statement is, I am doing this work because.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Yeah. Because that's what you're bringing to the conversation with a funder that makes you unique. They have to know that you have a backbone, that you're serious about the work that you're doing. You're not desperate. What you're saying to the funder is, I'm bringing you an opportunity. You can come with me, amplify your values in the world, do good in the world, and you'll feel great about it. Or you can ignore this opportunity, in which case I feel sorry for you.
but that's a position of strength that you just laid out, not the position of desperation, which is 99% of all filmmakers looking for money for their projects. And it's, I mean, if for anyone listening, you just have, I mean, if you're trying to go out with a guy or a girl and either one, and you are just like on top of them and emailing them and stalking them on Facebook and trying to just like this sense of desperation. Nobody wants to be around that. And I've tried to say that so many times. And that's not just with fundraising, just like building relationships with people. Like it's a people thing. You it's a people business. You need to build authentic relationships built on real values, like you said, in order for anything to happen. But if you start asking people, the second I meet you, hey, Maury, I'm looking for $50,000 for my project. I know you. I just met you, Maury.
Bye-bye.
But you fundraised a lot. I think you and I can work together. I really need the money. Can you give it to me, Maury?
No, because. You know, when you're fundraising, you have to understand when to approach the donor with the ask.
Mm-hmm. And how do you do – so, okay, so let's say, how do you approach an individual donor? We'll talk about the other entities later, but specifically an individual owner, a donor, how do you build that relationship, do the outreach, and then start – because you don't do it like right away. Like how do you build that kind of – that game plan, that blueprint?
Well, you have to understand that there's a ladder of involvement with anyone. Could be an individual, could be a group, an organization, a funder, corporation. There's a ladder of involvement. And at the top of the ladder is, I am a rabid fan of yours. I love you. I will do anything for you. I will write you a check. I will beg my friends to give you money. That's at the top of the ladder. At the bottom of the ladder is, who the hell are you? I don't know you. Why would I want to know you, right? Mm-hmm. And then there's all these steps in between. And what I tell my clients is, be conscious of where you are in the ladder with anyone you are talking to. And what you want to do is you want to move people up the ladder of involvement and engagement. Only at a certain point in the ladder are you ready to make an ask for the money. And until then, you're not ready. And that's why relationship building and community building are basic to this business now. That's what you should be doing all the time is as you cast around your environment, every time you write a letter, every time you post something to social media, every time you decide which social media avenue to use, you have to say to yourself, how can I move people up the ladder of involvement? How can I make rabid fans? Because that's what pays off 1,000%. So let's say that I wanted to get money from you. Mm-hmm. Well, the first thing I'd have to ask myself is, why do I think that Alex would want to give me money? I don't know Alex. I've never met him. So I do research. I research Alex. I'll go to the internet. I'll Google Alex. I'll read your profile. I'll find out what your interests are. What I really want to find out is, where have you given money before? Who have you given money to? Is my project going to be warm to you? Is it going to contain something in it that you might want to help me with? And then the second thing I want to ask is, what do I want from Alex? I might want money. I always want money. But maybe I want Alex's expertise, mm-hmm. right? Maybe what I could use from Alex is the use of his name as an advisor, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe I want Alex so I could just pick his brain. So there's maybe Alex has some equipment I could use and I want to borrow it for free or get it at a reduced price. So you want to be strategic is what I'm saying.
Right.
And you have to bring that strategic attitude to every involvement with every person. It takes work. And research is at the basis of that. So once I've identified two things, one is what I want from you and what you're able to give. And the second thing is, what are your values? What are you interested in? Then the third thing I want to do is I want to see where you are on that ladder of involvement with me. Mm-hmm. Right? And then I want to start drawing you in. And it might be with sending an email. It might be with becoming a follower of yours on Facebook. It might be with requesting that you follow me. It might be with my talking to a friend of yours who's a friend of mine to see if there would be an introduction. Because you're never...
That's very powerful.
You're never more than three people away from anybody on earth, really. Mm-hmm. I mean, 6 degrees of separation at the most. But almost anybody you want to get to, you can in like three stops along your friendships.
And if your name is Kevin Bacon, even faster. No, but so I completely understand your point too. But so sometimes the approach that you're proposing is more of someone giving and supporting you, but there should be some sort of value you're providing them, and that value could be experience. That value could be hanging out with movie stars. That value could be financial. That value could be I'm bored with my life and I just want to go do something cool that I've never done before. There's other things that you're presenting as well. So it's not just what can you do for me, but it's also what I can do for you. Is that correct?
That's right. And I have to know that before I talk to you,
right?
If I can. If I don't, then there are ways to find that out, like with you. Mm-hmm. But it wouldn't be at a first meeting ask. Mm-hmm. It might be at a first meeting lunch or a phone call or whatever. I have to know what you, the donor, need from me. What do you really want? Can I provide that? And it's different with every donor. Don't assume that every donor wants the same thing. So if I give you like two extremes of donors, there's the donor who I'd call an investor, and that person wants money, mm-hmm. right? Pure and simple. And if you can't give them an avenue towards a potential payback, they don't want to be with you. And then at the other end of the spectrum, there's a donor that just wants to feel good and let you do whatever you need to do. Because they want to see something good happen, and they don't want anything back. They want to remain anonymous. They don't even want their name on the front. And then there's everything in between. And most people and donors are in between somewhere. But those are the two antipodes. And I have to understand where you are on that spectrum before I make the ask.
Yeah, without question. So now that you have, okay, so let's say you're building this relationship. What are the elements of a perfect pitch? Like, how do you do that pitch? Because that's a whole other, I've spoken about pitching extensively throughout my years on the show, and it is an art. It is an art, and it's not for everybody. So if you don't know how to pitch, either learn or hire somebody or find someone who can actually pitch well. If not, you're done.
So there's a lot to say about the pitch. Mm-hmm. The first thing I would say is you must have a pitch.
Step one.
And I don't care if you don't like pitching, don't know how to pitch, yada, yada, yada. You as the filmmaker must have a pitch, and it must be no more than 20 seconds long.
It's tough.
This is a basic pitch that you must create. And I'll tell you why in a second. You can have longer pitches, but the big pitch, the one that you must have, is at least one 20-second pitch. I often recommend that you have a couple of different short pitches, depending on where you are and who you're talking to. And it must be compelling. And the purpose of the pitch is it needs to reel your interest in if you are likely to be interested. Now, remember, there's a whole universe of people who are never going to be interested. Mm-hmm. Forget them. What you're interested in is that small unit of people who are likely to be interested. And your job is to reel them in and make them want to talk to you and ask questions. The pitch is like such a powerful tool. It makes you money all the time. Because, I mean, here's the typical situation. You're at the grocery store, Safeway, and you're in line waiting to pay for your goods. And it turns out the line is long. So you turn around to the person behind you and you say, I'm always in the wrong line. Right? Even if I'm in the shortest line, it ends up being the longest line. Right? And the other person says, and this is actually a true story that happened in San Francisco at the Safeway in the Marin.
Okay.
The filmmaker told me this story, right? So she's talking to this guy behind him. It's actually one of those places where singles go to meet up. But at any rate, so she says to him, you know, what I just said. And he says, yeah, I come to this store all the time and I always have to wait in line. And she says to him, well, what do you do? And he says, well, I'm in accounting. I'm an accountant. And he says, well, what do you do? He says to her, what do you do? And she says, well, I'm a filmmaker. How many times has this happened to you in the world, right? She says, I'm an independent filmmaker. And he says, oh, that's interesting. What are you working on? Are you with me? He says to her, what are you working on? Now, if she doesn't have a pitch, she's going to blow that moment, right? Turns out this woman has a pitch. It's 20 seconds long. She's in the Safeway line, right? In about 2 minutes, she's going to be up there spending money and saying goodbye to this guy. She gives him this pitch, and he goes, oh, my God, that is really an interesting project. Give me your card. I want to talk to you about it, right? 2 weeks later, she gets $10,000. So the pitch isn't always going to get you the money. But if you don't have the pitch, it's not going to get you the money. It highly increases the likelihood of your meeting the right people and getting the right things that you need. You must have the pitch. Okay, so you asked, how do you ask for the money? That's a little separate science.
Right, right. Well, so, all right. So before we get to that, so just for everyone to listening, it's the equivalent of being a painter and having a brush and paint increases the likelihood of you actually painting something. You might have the canvas, but if you don't have the brush and the paint, it just increases the chances of you actually ever painting anything. So that's a pitch.
So what I'm trying to say on a big meta level is you are trying every moment of your life as a filmmaker to increase the likelihood of success for you, your film, fundraising, and distribution. Mm-hmm. That's why you want to be strategic. You want your comportment to work for you. You want everything in your environment to piggyback and work for you. So you need to be conscious about all of those elements. And when you are, they pay off.
Without question. So then how do you, okay, so now you have the pitch for the project, but how do you ask for the money?
So the first thing is you have to know that the donor is ready for your pitch. So they have to be on that ladder of involvement somewhere where they're, and it can't be like a cold call. Mm-hmm. Okay. The second thing is, if you are really bad at pitching, you are allowed to bring someone with you for the ask who's good at it. So that's a good thing for a filmmaker to know. If you're a very, very introverted filmmaker who stutters or whatever, you can bring someone with you to the ask if it's appropriate. So sometimes I'll have a tag team go in, which is really strong. But let's say you're going by yourself. The first thing is you know that they're ready. The second thing, very important, what am I going to ask for? You must have a specific thing or a specific amount of money that you will ask for. That's part of the equation of the pitch. You don't want to go in and say, I need support. How much can you give?
Ooh, no.
Big mistake.
Right.
Or I need support. I'll take anything you can give.
Ooh.
No. Mm-mm. No. You need to research and know what their comfort zone of giving is. Find out how much they've given to other things in the world. Quite often, it's a big surprise. You never want to ask for less than their comfort zone is. That's a mistake. You are allowed to ask for above their comfort zone. If you ask below, let's say I'm the donor. Remember that donors are experts at donating. Mm-hmm. They get pitched all the time. So while you're pitching them, in what's going through their mind, put yourself in their shoes. Well, the first thing they're saying is, how good is this guy at pitching? Oh, he's asking me for $500. He doesn't know that I could give $50,000. Right? That's going through their mind. So you want to know their comfort zone of giving before you ask. Mm-hmm. So the typical rhythm of the ask, if all of those things are in place, oh, and by the way, you'd like to control the environment where the ask happens. So quite often you have to go to their environment. Sometimes, I mean, the best scenario is if they come to your environment. If you have a studio and they come to your studio, that's my favorite place to ask, is your environment, because they see you and you have control. And then there's everything in between, like restaurants, which I'm not fond of because of the noise problem and privacy, blah, blah, blah.
So let me ask you, though. So when you're asking for money for a film, there is some legal things you have to have in place, like a PPM and all that kind of stuff. Or is that not true?
Well, what are you asking for? If you're asking for a donation,
different,
a tax deductible donation, then either you have to have your own nonprofit, or you have to have another nonprofit that's working for you, right?
Right.
A fiscal sponsor to give the money through. And there are many good ones around the country. They usually take a small percentage, anywhere from 3% to 10%, I think, is high. 3% is very low. Most of them will ask like 6 or 7%. Sometimes you can get one for free if they're a nonprofit that loves you and loves the project, sometimes. But fiscal sponsor is something else we can talk about. Mm-hmm. So when you're making the ask, if you're asking for a donation, a nonprofit charitable donation, then you must have a fiscal sponsor. If you're asking for an investment, then that's not really a donation. That's different. And then you must have a legal structure that's ready to accept that money in some way. An LLC or blah, right. blah, blah. But there is something in between, which is like a no interest or a low interest loan.
Right.
Sometimes you ask for that, and then you don't need a legal structure. But you do need to have a lawyer on your team, and you have to have an instrument that's ready to accept the money, or don't make the ask.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now, back to the show.
Right, right. Because if they're, you know, if I'm like, hey, just write the check out to Alex, that's probably not a good idea. It opens you up personally to a lot of liability. It could open up. It could be a bad thing. So you're right. An LLC. If you have a corporation, you could do it through that. But I would have created an LLC for the project regardless, just to protect yourself and your assets.
Absolutely. That's kind of bottom line, good, basic advice. Yeah. Always create that structure. Yeah. So to get back to the ask, do you want to?
Yes, continue. Continue.
So let's say I'm coming to your office, Alex's office. So the rhythm of the ask is I'll sit down and I don't want to begin by asking. I want to spend just a couple of minutes being friendly. It's what I call ice break time. So I should be ready to ask you or engage you in some kind of icebreaker. Now, the best scenario is we know each other. I've already talked to you before. So I might come in and say, well, the weather's great. And, oh, by the way, how's your family? You know, is your son still playing softball, blah, blah, blah? Something to break the ice. If, God forbid, you go in and you've never met the person before and you don't know much about them, which I never recommend, but let's say that happens, I might look around the room for a cue. Mm-hmm. And the cue might be pictures of your family. It might be a fish up on the wall, so I know that you're a fisher person. I'll talk about that. Anything to, like, break the ice. So you break the ice, but the rule about ice breaking is don't do it too long because that's unprofessional. You'll get a feel for when it's time to get into the ask. So when the ice break is over, then you'll talk about the project. You'll give your pitch. You don't want to make it too long. You don't want to bore the donor. Ideally, they already have something in front of them about the project. So you talk a little bit about the project, and then you ask them if they have any questions. Now, the rule for the questions is, let that go on as long as the donor wants to make it happen. Mm. Now it's in their court. If they're interested and they're asking, let them ask whatever they have to ask. But at some point, you'll know that the time to talk about the project is over. And now you must make a direct ask for the money. And the direct ask has like a little equation to it, a little formula. The first part of the formula is, I have to look you straight in the eyes. Very important.
Very, very important.
Don't be looking down. Don't be looking over here. Don't be shy about it. You have to look them right in the eye. And then you have to say, well, I know that you don't have any more questions about it, about the project. I know that you're interested. We both know how important this project is. I'd like to ask you for a donation of $10,000 that I will use for post-production. Period. Okay. So you ask for a specific thing and a specific amount. And then the next rule, and it's a huge, important, inviolable rule for the ask is, shut up. And the rule is, you zip up and the next person to talk loses. It's not going to be you. That moment or moments of silence can be very awkward and hard for you. You don't want to interrupt by going, oh, but if you need more, or I understand. No. The next person to talk is the donor. Let them sit back as much time as they need, whatever. Your job now is to shut up and not say anything. And they will say something next. And they have like three paths they can follow. The first path, the one you're hoping for, is I'm going to write you that check right now. Mm-hmm. I love this project. Not only am I going to write this check, I'm going to tell my friends I have to give, use my name all over it, blah, blah, blah. You're hoping that'll happen. The second scenario is they say, you know, I'm going to need a little more time to think. Now, if they go down that path, which is not unusual, then you still have to, for path number one, if they say they want to give, close the deal. Find out when and how they want to give you the money or the stocks or whatever, and make sure they understand your fiscal sponsor interface or the legalities, whatever. Get that all straight. If they go down the second path, which is maybe, then you still need to close. You say, I understand completely. What information can I give you? Do you need to talk to other people? How much time do you want? And the donor will say, you know, I'm real busy right now. How about 2 weeks? And you'll say, fine. Should I call you? Should I email you? Or do you want me to come back? Should we set up an appointment? You must close the time and date that that maybe will get resolved. Okay? So remember that most of the time, if you've really done your homework and you've done your relationship building, one of those first two scenarios is going to happen. But there is a third scenario, the one you don't like, you're unhappy about, and that is they say, you know, this project isn't for me. I just can't help you at this time. So you have to not take it personally, which is very difficult. And what you need to do is understand more about the rejection. Don't be mad about it. Accept it. Don't never argue about it. Mm-hmm. Never. This is a big mistake. And I see filmmakers make this mistake all the time. They get rejected by a funder, for instance. They'll call the funder up and say, how dare you?
Don't you know who I am?
Don't you know who I am? This project should have been, you know, never do that. So let's say they say no, then you politely will say, well, can you give me a little more information about your hesitancy or your difficulty in funding this project? Just for my own information. And thank you for your time. Do you want to stay in? Can I keep sending you information about the project, or can I keep you on my mailing list? Something like that. And then you leave. Always, always follow up with a thank you note or thank you email for their time, even if they say no. And that's the ask.
And that is the ask. Very cool. Now, in your book, you were talking about house parties, and I found that very interesting. What is the fundraising house party? Because when I think of house party, I think of the 90s and Kid and Play, but that's just my generation. So what kind of house parties are you talking about?
Well, by this book, it's the Bible on house parties.
Okay.
I'm shocked that you don't know about house parties, because they've become really, really popular. I'll tell you how I got introduced to house parties. Well, first of all, the history of house parties goes back to politics. Politicians have been doing house parties since the days of Socrates.
Interesting.
Oh, yeah. That's how they raise a lot of their money. But when I was working at the Bay Area Video Coalition, I met a filmmaker who was in there editing one day, and I said, how are you getting money for this project? She said, I do house parties. I said, you do what? What's a house party? And she explained to me the rudimentary science of house parties. And then I got crazy about them because they work. If you do them right, they always work. Okay. That's what I love about the house party. But there's a big proviso, and that is you must do them right. But very simply, people get invited to someone's home, and usually it's not your home. And they get asked for money, and they give money, and then they go home, and you take the money with you. That's like a real quick encapsulation.
But what
course,
are you?
There's a lot more to it.
So what value are you providing for them at this house party? I'm assuming it's a party, so there's music and there's food and other things like that, or are you literally just, it's a Tupperware party, and instead of selling Tupperware, you're getting money. How does that work?
Well, the first thing is everyone who comes to the party knows that they are going to be asked for money.
Important.
Very important. It's a mistake to send out an invitation and not let people know they're going to be asked for money. That's a huge mistake.
Okay.
So the great thing about sending out an invitation that says to the person, we're throwing, and it's usually not coming from the filmmaker, it's coming from a friend of the filmmaker. Ideally, someone has already donated to the filmmaker and they're inviting their friends. They're saying to their friends, here's a project I'm crazy about. I love this filmmaker, Alex. I'm going to have him over to my house so that you can learn about this project. Bring your checkbook, your credit card, and cash. Right? So that's why it's important that you send out invitations to three or four times as many people as you'd like to have at the party. And typically, you'd like to have a party with 10 to 20 people. So you invite 80 people. But most of them don't want to come because you're going to ask them for money. Well, the beauty of that is they're not coming to the party and they were never going to give you money.
Right, exactly.
You fill them up. And the corollary is, the important corollary is, everyone who does come to the party knows that they're going to be asked for money. They're bringing their checkbook. They're bringing cash. They're bringing their credit cards. And that means if you do the party right correctly, 70% of the people who come will give you money.
So how do you do it right? What is that? You said that a few times already. So what is the right way to do it?
Well, the first right way is you have to have a good host, the person who's going to throw the party. The second right way is the host puts together a little invitation team of their friends. The third right way is you send out the right invitation, be it an evite or a physical invitation. The fourth thing is the invitation must have an RSVP that allows the person to give you money without coming.
Okay.
So there are some people who just can't come, but they want to donate. Before the party even happens, you're going to make money. Okay, so that's part A before you go to the party. The second part is the party itself. The big rule is it must be someone's domicile where they live. Not a factory, not a fancy office, not a restaurant. A house, an apartment, a tent, a yurt, wherever the person lives, because the significance of crossing the threshold into your private space is so strong, it can't be replicated in any other environment. It says to people right away, I'm really invested, and that's why I'm allowing you to come into my house and keep your shoes on and get the floors dirty. Okay, so you want that to happen. You have to prepare the host, and the host has to be ready to, at the very least, invite everyone and welcome them when they show up. At the most, it's great if the host will make the ask that night, and I'll talk about the rhythm of the party. So the party begins, people show up, and you must have some kind of food, but not a dinner. Not a sit-down dinner. It's got to be food that people can put on a plate and eat with their hands and walk around and mingle. And you have to be ready to juice the mingling. You might have alcoholic beverages, but not hard liquor, right? Depends on where you are and what the environment is and who's coming. But I would allow some alcohol, but not hard liquor. Maybe some wine. Most hosts don't like to have red wine because people are going to spill it, yada, yada, yada. So you want the food to be ready. Now, typically the host will pay for the food, but sometimes you have to pay for the food, right? Okay, so whatever. So you got the food, you let people mingle, you allow enough time for people to show up late. And then part two is you must have a place in the house prepared for people to sit down and have a formal presentation. So you gather all the people together in the room, and then you have a formal presentation, and there are three parts to the formal presentation. You have to do all this or you won't get the money. But if you do it right, you will.
Right.
The first part is the host welcomes everyone. The host has to say, I'm so excited. They have to show enthusiasm. And the other thing they must do is they must let people know that they've made a donation. Why would I want to donate if you haven't donated? Mm-hmm. Right? They can smell that a mile away. So they must let people know that. That's part one is the host. The second part is you, the filmmaker, do have a role in this. And you, the filmmaker, have to get up in front of the audience, and you must have a very short demo reel, a sample of the project. And it's got to be like pretty brief, like 3 to 7 minutes is a nice time frame. Mm-hmm. You don't want to show too much. But the key, my favorite, my ideal clip is one that makes people cry, or one that brings up some kind of emotion. I guarantee if you can make people cry at a house party, you don't even need to ask for money. They'll start throwing money at you. But if you don't have that kind of sample, well, at least something that teases people, tweaks their interest, gets them to want to see more.
Yeah, and that could be still a stills presentation, something that is explaining, you know, concept art, interviews if it's a documentary, mm-hmm. things like just something that could get them, like, you know, just wet their bill, if you will.
That's right. Yeah, and so the extreme is you haven't actually started shooting and all you have is like still a storyboard or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. And the other extreme is you're getting ready for post-production and you actually do have like a professional sample.
Sure.
Something in between. But the point is get them involved, get them engaged. And then your next role is you have to open the floor for questions. People are going to want to ask you things you hope. Mm-hmm. You're desiring that. So, and the rule here is you don't want it to go too long, but you want to let people have their say and ask whatever they want. And then the next part is you're going to have someone who's going to make the ask. That person has to be prepared and ready to do the ask. Ideally, it's the host. But let's say the host is uncomfortable asking their friends for money directly. You'll say, fine, who's coming to the party? Who can we get to make the ask that night? And again, it must be someone who is going to give you money either that night or has already given you money. And the other important thing is that person has to be credible with the crowd that's there that night. Mm. So that's why you would like a homogeneous group and not a heterogeneous group. And that's why you have a lot of different house parties, because you don't want people in the room at different socioeconomic levels. You don't want someone in the room who could only give you $50 next to someone who could give you $50,000. You have to make sure that the room is in the same comfort zone of giving. It's really awkward if that's not true. And that will control the level of your ask that night, by the way. And, oh, the other thing you have to have ready is a card that people can fill out to give you money. And on that card, you'd like levels that are appropriate for the people who were there that night. But at any rate, the next big important part of the house party is someone has to stand up and ask for money. And they have to be very direct, not namby-pamby. And this is another big mistake that people make, is they don't ask for money. Mm-hmm. They'll throw a party and just hope that people see the pledge cards and give by the end of the evening. I've seen that happen. Doesn't work. Someone has to get up. Everybody knows why they're there. They have to get up and say, oh, and they're the person who decides when the talking period, Q&A, is over. They get up and say, Alex, okay, I think that's enough talking. Everybody here knows why we're here. If they don't already love your project, they should leave already. They're crazy. Look, you are all my friends. George, how long have we known each other? Sam, thank you for coming tonight. Look, let's get real. This project is only going to get made and must get made, by the way, if we can raise $50,000 tonight to get it to the next level. Let's do the math. There are 20 people in here. We need to raise $50,000. that's going to be, what is that, 5,000? I can't do the math real quick. I am hoping, I'm expecting each of you to give at least that much tonight. And if you can't, I want you to talk to me. Let me know why. Otherwise, you got a pledge card in front of you. We will take cash tonight if you carry that much. We'll take your personal check. We'll definitely take credit cards. If you want to give us your stocks and bonds, we'll work out a way to do that. Please go to your heart, and then I want you to go to your checkbook and your pocket and your pocketbook and give as much as you can. Thank you for coming tonight. And then you got to be ready to take the money. You got to have pens and pencils. I went to a party once where there weren't enough pens or pencils for the pledge cards. They lost money. And pledge cards, you have to have people ready with little baskets to take whatever. And then people mingle a little bit more. The party is over. But the party is not over because there's one more important thing you must do. You have to send a thank you note to everyone. You have to be sure that you've sealed the deal for people who want to give. Make that happen. And it might be an investment party or a giving party, a donor party, whatever. That's ready. But the third thing and the very important thing is anyone who came but didn't give you money must be contacted. And the ideal contact is from the host or the person who made the ask. But it might have to be you. And it has to be a very pleasant, friendly call, like maybe a week to 10 days later, saying, thank you so much for coming to the party. Did you enjoy it? How did you feel about it? I noticed that we didn't get a pledge card back from you. Might I ask, are you intending to give?
Yeah.
Right? If you do that, you will get 30% more money than you raised that evening. So if you got $10,000 in pledges that evening, you will raise another $3,000 with your phone calls. And that's it. What else can I tell you about
it's a It seems like you're in there. I mean, what you've just described, especially from the host, it's like, I expect all of you to do this, this, and this. And you can't do that by yourself. You need a host. You need someone who has an emotional connection with the people in the room who they trust and things like that. So it's not like a cold ask. It's a very warm, very, very warm ask. Yeah, and if you do multiple, you could do 2, 3, 4, 5 of them, depending on the network of people that you have as friends. You could easily raise the money that you need. I mean, obviously, depending on how big your budget is, but relatively speaking, you could definitely raise a good money. I see that. And you wrote, what was the name of the book that you wrote about that?
Well, oddly enough, it's called The Fundraising House Party.
I've never heard of this. I can't believe I've never heard of this concept of, because I've heard of candle parties, Tupperware parties, makeup parties, all these kind of parties that you go there knowing that they're going to sell you makeup or candles or Tupperware, but I never thought about it for fundraising. But I guess it works, and it makes perfect sense that politicians have been using it for years.
Yeah, and in fact, I got an email about 3 months ago from Vivian Kleinman, a filmmaker, an indie filmmaker. She just finished a really good documentary. And she, because of COVID, she started doing Zoom parties, Zoom house parties.
Wow.
Yeah, so I would love to get a little more about the details of it. But the long and the short of it is you still find a host and they do a Zoom meeting and make an ask over Zoom.
And then you set up a website for them to just click here and donate here. And I guess that's in the second edition. You'll do the second edition of that book with Zoom.
I'm trying to retire, so I don't know. But you do have to be ready to take money automatically. And you do need a website that will take credit cards on. Hope I don't need to tell people this, but you need to be able to accept money electronically and over the internet, make it really easy for folks.
Right. I mean, you can get a Square in right then and there, or PayPal, Swiper for credit cards at the party, but you should also have a website ready to accept credit card payments, you know, personal checks you could do and all that kind of stuff.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and again, you should have an LLC set up and bank account set up for that LLC to accept all this money. So it's not going directly to, you know, Alex.
Yeah, you know, the thing about being an indie filmmaker is you spend 80% of your time doing business.
You're absolutely right. And you, I always tell people, like, you know, this is the only art form where you spend 3 years to work for 3 months at best case scenarios to make the movie you want to do. Yeah. Like to make your movie in a narrative scenario. Most independent films don't have the luxury of 3 months. The more they have 6 weeks, if at all, you know, to make their movie. So you work 2 years just to get to that point and then you're done shooting. And then it's just the post-production process. And then you're back into business, selling it, distributing it, marketing it. It's not like it's not like painting or songwriting. You know, you can write a song today if you're so inclined, or paint or draw something today or paint something today. It's a brutal art form.
Because it's expensive. Yeah,
it's one of the most expensive art forms on the planet. No
question. I think after opera. Yeah,
after opera and architecture.
Architecture is an art form. Yeah.
Yes. No.
That's true. But it's up there in the top five. Let's say.
There's no question. Yeah. And you also need a lot of people. You can't do it on your own. Oh, you need a lot of people to do it.
You know, and that's very, very important because independent filmmakers. No. Interdependent. You must have two types of communities. One is a tight community right around you that's going to help you.
Mm-hmm.
Your team, very important. You don't want to be isolated. And then the other community is like the larger community, the ecology of groups, people, organizations, funders, blah, 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 that want to be with you, that want to help make the work and use the work, amplify the work. That's why a big part of your job now is creating and nurturing your community.
And can you, before we go, can you tell me a little bit about your daughter's new film, Big Sonia? Because I saw the trailer and it looks amazing. And did she use some of these techniques to raise money?
Oh, yeah. She's read my book many times. I was an advisor on the project. It's hilarious to see her doing documentary film work because when she grew up as a kid, this was like the last thing on her mind. And her history of how she got into film is really, really interesting. But I would encourage people to go to her website about the film, Big Sonia, S-O-N-I-A, and it's bigsonia.com to learn about the film. I have many, many fundraising stories about Big Sonia, not only fundraising for pre-production, production, and post-production, but fundraising for distribution, community outreach. She is still fundraising today. And the film came out 3 years ago.
Interesting.
And it took 7 years to fundraise and make the film. We're into like year 10 or 11 on this film, folks.
Jesus. Yeah.
That's what it takes. Yeah, but I've got like dozens and dozens of stories. I'll tell you an interesting story recently was we're fundraising now for a community outreach. Are you all familiar with the Shoah Project?
Yeah, of course, yeah.
So the Shoah Project, the USC Spielberg's project, they have this new thing they started a year ago where they do intensive interviews with a survivor of the Holocaust, and they create a 3D and or hologram version of the person so that later on you can interact with them in real time. They ask them like 1,000 questions. They store it in computers, blah, blah, blah. So we're fundraising now to complete that project. So one of the things I tell my filmmakers is that marketing is fundraising. Public relations is fundraising. So 2 weeks ago, an article showed up in a newspaper about this project. And a day later, Leah's fiscal sponsor in Seattle, Oregon, the Northwest Film Project, called her up and said, well, we just got this donation for $1,000. Do you know who it's from? It was this woman who read about the project, got excited, wanted to see it happen, and wrote out a check immediately for it.
Wow.
So the kernel of that is there are a lot of lessons in that. And they have to do with comportment, marketing, pitching, the whole range of things. But you're always doing that, and you're always trying to be strategic, and you're always trying to make it happen.
And one last question. What is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in the film industry or in life?
Oh, self-awareness. That's an easy one to answer.
Mm.
That's why comportment is the big word in my work now. Self-awareness. Understanding who I am really, what my real core values are, why I'm doing this work, whether or not I should be doing it, is it really important to me? And the other thing was, how do I come across to people? That was a big lesson for me to learn, and it changed my work dramatically, understanding that. And it shapes everything I do.
And where can people buy your book, Shaking the Money Tree?
Oh, well, the best place is to come to my website, warshawski.com, warshawski.com. You can buy them directly from me, and I'll even autograph them. Or, of course, you can go to Amazon. So they're available on Amazon as well.
Maury, thank you so much for being on the show. And thank you for writing this book. I think it's a book that many, if not all, filmmakers need to read at one point or another in their careers until, obviously, they're loaded and filthy rich and they can self-finance their things or just call up Mr. Spielberg and go, Steve, I got a project. Can you fund it for me? Until those days come, I think we're going to be needing these tools for a long time. So I appreciate you for you being on the show, my friend. Thank you.
My pleasure. Take care. Adios.
I want to thank Maury so much for coming on the show and showing us how to raise money for our projects. I hope you guys got some ideas about how you can raise some money, whether through donations, through grants, or through private investors and everything in between. So thank you again so much, Maury. If you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, including how to get his books, Shaking the Money Tree, and how to throw a house party, how to raise money through a house party, head over to the show notes at indiefilmhustle.com/505. And if you haven't already, please subscribe and leave a good review for the show wherever you are listening to this podcast. It really helps the show out a lot. Thank you again so much for listening, guys. As always, keep that hustle going. Keep that dream alive. Stay safe out there. And I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Indie Film Hustle podcast at indiefilmhustle.com. That's IndieFilmHustle.com.